Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Tonight on The Readout.
What Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus. It just stacks tragedy upon tragedy.
And it can't be the appropriate, you know, it's become transfer is the appropriate standard of care in Idaho, but it can't be the right standard of care to force somebody onto a helicopter.
The Supreme Court hears two monumental cases this week. Today, on whether federal law requires emergency abortion care in states with strict bans. The other one tomorrow will determine if Donald Trump faces any consequences at all for his alleged crimes. And that's where we begin tonight. Legal accountability for one man, Donald Trump, from two different courts. Trump certainly believes that the rules do not apply to him. It's a central part of who he is as a person. But in one court, the New York State Supreme Court, we are waiting on a decision from Judge Juan Marchand on whether Donald Trump will face consequences for 10 alleged violations of his gag order in his hush money election interference trial. Trump seems to be going out of his way to prove a point that prosecutor Christopher Conroy argued on Tuesday. He knows what he's not allowed to do, and he does it anyway. It turns out, in an interview just minutes before that hearing on the gag order started, Trump committed what appears to be yet another violation of the gag order, going after his former fixer, Michael Cohen, a key witness, during an interview with a local Philadelphia station.
Michael Cohen is a convicted liar, and he's got no credibility whatsoever. He was a lawyer, and you rely on your lawyers. But Michael Cohen was a convicted liar.
Now, it should be noted, yes, by his own admission, Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to lying to Congress and lying to a bank. So Trump is not making that part up. But it's important to remember why he committed those crimes and who he did them for. He did it to protect Donald Trump. Cohen lied to Congress about business deals Trump pursued in Russia while he was running for president because Trump wanted him to conceal those business deals so his Russia baggage wouldn't look so obvious. And Cohen lied to a bank to take out a home equity line of credit to pay to silence a woman alleging a sexual relationship with Donald Trump, namely Stormy Daniels. Trump weirdly keeps leaving out those details when he calls his former personal attorney and fixer a criminal, in clear violation, by the way, of a gag order. Tomorrow, there will be another chance to hold Donald Trump accountable in an unprecedented case with farther-reaching implications, not just for him, but for our democracy. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in Donald Trump versus the United States about whether he can claim sweeping presidential immunity over his criminal election interference charges from Special Counsel Jack Smith. But even for the conservative majority on the court, here's one word of arguments. It is important to recognize the gift that they've already handed to Trump, namely time and plenty of it, with a months-long delay. They refused Jack Smith's request to fast-track this case in December before a single Republican primary vote had been cast, sending it instead to the D.C. Circuit Court. The court also could have just affirmed the decision by the D.C. Circuit Court, which found that a president, surprise, surprise, does not in fact have absolute immunity from prosecution after Trump's lawyers made this absolutely absurd argument that they could reprise tomorrow.
Could a president who ordered SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival who was not impeached, would he be subject to criminal prosecution?
If he were impeached and convicted first. And so
your answer is no.
My answer is qualified yes.
Instead, this 6-3 right-wing majority court, three of whom were nominated by Donald Trump and another whose wife actively encouraged Trump's efforts to overturn the election and attended the rally that preceded the attack on the Capitol, they will decide whether or not Trump is above the law, even as he is already the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. Friends of the show, legal experts Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman write in the New York Times that the court has already botched the immunity case, noting the court's decision to review the immunity case actually undermines core democratic values. And joining me now is the aforementioned Andrew Weissman, former FBI general counsel, MSNBC legal analyst, and co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast, and Timothy Hafey, former lead investigator for the House January 6th Select Committee. I forgot my copy of my book. I always bring the Trump indictments book everywhere I go. I take it around that. Like Trump takes his pretend Bible that he wrote the open to. Say more. Your op-ed was important, so I want you to say more.
Sure. You know, what we really focus is on time, on the thing that you were talking about, because the main issue here is you can understand the Supreme Court if it wanted to say, you know what, we as the Supreme Court have never actually ruled on something as crazy as a president saying they're absolutely criminally immune from prosecution.
Yeah.
So we've never addressed that. We've only addressed that in the civil context. So I could understand that they might want to weigh in on that. There's no way that there's going to be immunity in this case, even if you think that there is going to be some small area that the president should be criminally immune. I'm not sure there should be, but it's certainly not this case where there's private action for private gain. It's just not an official duty. And so what's the real harm here is that the Supreme Court could have taken it, as you noted, in December. They could have, if they were going to take it a couple months ago instead of December, they could have said, we're going to fast track it and we would have heard arguments already.
Yeah.
Instead, there has been a stay in the D.C. federal case since December. Mm. That case was originally scheduled for trial March 4th. Mm-hmm. You know where we are now? We could easily be waiting for a jury verdict right
That's
now.
That's right.
And so what I'm hoping is that at the arguments tomorrow, that the justices focus on speed. Like, what legitimate argument does Donald Trump have for why this shouldn't be decided immediately? Or the court could say, let's lift the stay tomorrow.
Yeah.
We'll hear from you, but you know what? You don't have five votes for presidential immunity in this case. The stay is lifted.
Yeah.
The case can go forward. We'll issue an opinion in time.
Sure.
That's something they have done. Mm-hmm. It's something other courts have done. And that would, I think, in some way absolve them from what they have done so far. But I have to say the tea leaf reading, not good.
Not good. And Timothy Hafey, just reprise for us, just for folks who have, it's gone in the memory hole, it's been so long since January 2021. Trump's role as an investigator of January 6th in what happened.
He was the leader of a multi-part intentional conspiracy to disrupt the joint session and interfere with the peaceful transfer of power. The story, Joy, that we told over the course of the Select Committee's hearings and in the final report, very similar to the evidence that has been amassed by and will be presented by the special counsel. He is far and away the proximate cause of the riot, as the committee found and as the special counsel will have the burden to prove in the trial.
Right. And Tim, if you were, and I'll ask both of you, if Donald Trump were not president of the United States, given the fact that people are spending 20 plus years in prison for what happened on January 6th, I'll start with you, Tim Hafey. Would he have been a defendant in a case were he not the president, like long before now?
Absolutely. Look, the Justice Department started with the blue collar cases, the people that were at the Capitol, and they eventually got around to the white collar defendants, like the chief among them, the former president. But absolutely, Joy, regardless of his status as the president of the United States, his conduct, as the Select Committee recommended and as the special counsel has now indicted, absolutely merits criminal prosecution.
And by the way, let me just remind someone who else was involved in this. Ginni Thomas, Andrew, here's some of her texts on November 6th after Trump lost the election. Do not concede. It takes time for the army who is gathering for his back. November 10, help this great president stand firm, Mark. That's Mark Meadows, his chief of staff. She's texting. You are the leader with him who is standing for America's constitutional governance at the precipice. The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist in all caps, or first letter cap, of our history. November 19, sounds like Sidney Powell and her team are getting inundated with evidence of fraud. Make a plan, release the Kraken, and save us from the left talking America down. Two of the people that are in these texts, Andrew, are already indicted in the state of Georgia. The idea that the husband of that woman, she sent 29 messages like that to Mark Meadows alone.
So Donald Trump, as you were starting out, has attacked Judge Mershon for being conflicted and shouldn't be sitting on this case. Said the same thing with respect to Fannie Willis, the DA in Georgia. These are people he has no problem attacking them as being conflicted. Clarence Thomas's wife was at the Ellipse, the key event before the January 6th attack. She was texting, as you noted, back and forth with the chief of staff, Mark Meadows. The idea that he is going to doesn't have the decency to and when you think about the how the public has been perceived the Supreme Court,
yeah,
the harm to the Supreme Court mm-hmm. from his sitting on this case,
yeah,
to say that there would be no appearance of impropriety, that yeah. you wouldn't have that and that no reasonable person could think that mm-hmm. when your own wife was goading on doing exactly what happened,
yeah.
it seems incredible to me.
I think you said the right phrase there, doesn't have the decency. And I will just leave it there while I just go back to some breaking news, actually. We have breaking news right now from Arizona involving the fake elector plot. Let's get right to NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard with the details. Vaughn, what have you got?
Hey, Joy, this is literally just in the last 60 seconds. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is announcing the indictment of the 11 electors out of Arizona from the 2020 election. This has been a part of a year-long investigation for Chris Mays. Of course, there was a Republican attorney general in the aftermath of the 2020 election who never investigated the fake elector scheme on his part. Upon taking office, she committed to this investigation, and over the better part of the last year, she has gone through this, issuing subpoenas and having individuals testify before this grand jury. And just here in the last hour in Arizona, Chris Mays, with the approval of a state grand jury, has now indicted 11 fake electors out of Arizona. I should note, as we're beginning to make our way through this indictment, there are other individuals who are also included in this indictment, but they have not been served at this time. The indictment has those names redacted. Mm. The 11 individuals who have been indicted, who we have the names of, include the likes of Kelly Ward, who folks will recall was the Arizona GOP chairwoman at the time, as well as her husband, as well as RNC committee man out of Arizona, Tyler Boyer, who also serves as the chief operating officer of Turning Point USA, that Trump-aligned organization. You also have two current Arizona state legislators who are included in this indictment. Around in the aftermath of the 2020 election, Joy, in some states, right, there was more secretive effort to keep the fake elector scheme under wraps, right, in the state of Georgia, a secret meeting behind closed doors. In Arizona, it was a little bit different. More than a month after the 2020 election results, as Donald Trump was applying a pressure campaign on the likes of Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, as well as former House Speaker Rusty Bowers, you folks may recall that at the Arizona GOP headquarters, Kelly Ward, the GOP chairwoman of the state party at the time, actually convened a group of individuals, including the 11 electors, one of whom she was, to actually have on video them going and signing the certificate. At that point in time, the certificate was sent to the National Archives in Congress. So again, Joy, literally, as you and I are discussing here, we're just beginning to make our way through this indictment. But now we have individuals who were electors in Georgia and Michigan and now in Arizona as well, who have been formally indicted on state charges stemming from this alleged scheme to send to Washington, D.C., ultimately a different slate of electors to be counted on January 6th of 2021.
Don't go anywhere, Vaughn. I just want to hold on to you for just a second. Andrew Weissman, I want to get first to your reaction. I also want to get Tim Hafey's reaction, but I want to go to you first, Andrew.
Sure. I'm fascinated by the fact that Vaughn is reporting that they're redacted names.
That was my question, too. Yeah.
And I wonder if Vaughn could speak to, it sounds like they were able to serve people who are local, who might be Arizona people. From that, would it be fair to infer that there may be people who, you know, because the scheme as alleged in elsewhere right. in various indictments is that people at the Trump campaign were orchestrating this. In other words, this didn't come from the bottom up. This was coming from D.C. down. Is there, from that, could you infer that at least some of the redacted names may be, you know, people who are in the Trump campaign?
Right. Andrew, I'm actually, if you'll work with me, I'm looking the same screen that I have my camera on here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 names are redacted. So there were the 11 electors, fake electors out of Arizona, and 7 additional names that are redacted here. When we are looking at multiple counts, 9 different counts, count 1, conspiracy, count 2, fraudulent schemes, count 3, fraudulent schemes and practices, and counts 4 through 9 are forgery. We also, in all 11 of those individuals, were all indicted on all 9 of those counts. The 7 redacted names, we do not have the counts on as well. So I'm going to have to scan through this just so folks know what we're scanning through here. We're looking at, from Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, a 58-page indictment that was signed here by the 4-person just here in this last hour. So to better answer everybody's questions here, I'm going to work my way through this here in real time, if I may, guys.
Yeah, let me let you work through it. So I'm going to take you off camera for a minute, let you work through that. I'm going to let you keep reading. I'm going to get Timothy Hafey to go ahead and give us your response. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, no, it sounds very consistent with the Michigan case, with a portion of the Georgia case. As Andrew said, this was a top-down scheme. It was the RNC and members of the Trump campaign who were encouraging electors in these contested states to submit certificates purporting to be official. That's where the crime comes in, certifying falsely that President Trump had won those states. The signature on those documents and the attempt to have them considered by Congress is what makes them fraudulent. They are fake elector certificates. The redacted names could very well be officials of the Trump campaign. Mike Roman comes to mind. He's indicted in Georgia and was one of the people who was on the phone organizing this activity with individuals in Michigan, in Arizona, and in Georgia. So my guess is it's the individuals in Arizona who have been named, and then it's some additional folks in Washington or elsewhere that were part of the broader scheme to get all 7 of these contested states to submit these fake elector certificates. All of that, of course, sets up some predicate for dispute, something for the vice president potentially to accept at the joint session, a basis on which members of Congress could object. It was all part of a broader scheme led by the former president. That's what's at stake in these criminal cases in Washington and Georgia.
Andrew, I'm not a math person, but 11 electors indicted plus 9 redacted says 20 to me. A lot of people talked about how broad the Georgia indictment was, but that indictment included fake electors, people who were part of that scheme. It also included not just people from the Trump campaign, but very ostentatiously people from the Trump White House, including yep. his chief of staff. Yep. So if you're looking at an indictment this broad and you've got names redacted, shouldn't that say feds to us as well? Federal, well, people who are federal officials, maybe. Yeah, but maybe.
I mean, the thing I just sort of think is if they've unredacted the Arizona people, does, you know, I'm just sort of logically, it would yeah. suggest those people maybe outside of the state. And given that the scheme was really orchestrated, as we keep on saying, top down,
yeah.
I'm going to be interested in who the top people are that are getting indicted. And remember, but for Donald Trump, if he becomes president again, he may have immunity. These state charges, people should remember,
yeah.
they stick.
Yeah.
There is no federal pardon power for these charges. So when we find out the full panoply, the
yeah.
pressure on them is great because they can't be sitting there thinking, oh, I don't have to worry because
yeah.
Donald Trump, if he becomes president, he's going to pardon me. That they're going to hold the bag.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
Let me go back to Vaughn really quickly, because we do have this list of redacted names. Is there some way to eliminate the possibility that, as is the case in Georgia, Trump's name is on that list?
It's a very good question, Joy. We have no reporting that suggested that Donald Trump had received a subpoena or even a request to appear before this grand jury. So the extent to Chris May's investigation is still, frankly, not clear. I think that when we're looking at Chris Mayes here, again, I got to come back to the fact that she didn't come into office until in 2023 here. Essentially, she had a 2-year delayed start in being able to pick up this investigation. And when she came into office, in a race that she won by just about 270 votes, she made the commitment. She said that she needed to send a clear message that trying to overturn Democratic elections in the state of Arizona, to those who attempt to do that, that a clear message will be sent that they will not be able to do that into the future, and that she found it imperative to go forward with this investigation, despite others suggesting, you know, 3.5 years have passed at this point. But we, the American public, became familiar with Rusty Bowers' own story. Of course, Rusty Bowers was the speaker of the Arizona legislature at the time when he says and testified to this, that he got phone calls from the likes of Donald Trump and allies urging him to send this alternate slate of electors on behalf of the legislature, right? So these guys on December 14th at Arizona GOP headquarters, they were all there on video signing their names, all 11 of them, on this certificate that was sent to Congress. But they were also in real time trying to more formally use the legislature to send and make that the formal certificate sent by the state of Arizona, not the Biden slate of electors. Rusty Bowers said, sorry, we're not going with that game plan. We, as the Arizona state legislature, are sending the Biden slate of electors. Folks will also recall, Joy, Doug Ducey, the governor, was then the next individual who was a part of that pressure campaign. And folks will recall when he later that month in December was literally signing the certificate that Biden had won the state of Arizona, his phone rang and it was Donald Trump that was calling him, and he turned it over and left it on mute. And so this in the state of Arizona was the length to the means in which these individuals, the chairwoman of the state party, as well as the RNC committeeman, Tyler Boyer, went. And now we know as an extension of this, of course, Carrie Lake was, I should be clear, was not a part of this indictment here, but they are, this is, for all intents and purposes, the Republican Party of the state of Arizona.
Absolutely.
And now in a critical moment here for the state of Arizona and the Republican Party, just 6 months out from a general election, they have this indictment on their hands. It's a complicating scene, and one that I think that we're only beginning to wholly understand the details.
It's absolutely stunning. Kelly Ward, who is the Republican Party chair in the state of Arizona, asked and answered part of my question, was now asked. I can come to you on this, Andrew. So Donald Trump is apparently named as an unindicted co-conspirator in this indictment. Tell us what that means.
So that would mean he's not indicted.
So he's not indicted.
But you know, we saw that in the D.C. federal case where Donald Trump is indicted, but there were many unindicted co-conspirators who had different roles. And a number of us, including the media, figured out more or less who they were.
Yeah.
It was clear Rudy Giuliani was one.
Who was who. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, the reason they're not named is it's a euphemism, which is put up or shut up. Meaning, you know, if you're a federal prosecutor or a state prosecutor, if the grand jury is bringing charges, then you name the person. If they're not bringing charges, you do not name the person. Remember when Michael Cohen pled guilty federally, there was an unindicted co-conspirator.
Trump.
Was that Donald Trump?
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised.
But can you tell me, from a prosecutor's point of view, if someone is committing a crime, as Michael Cohen did for Donald Trump's benefit, not for his own, he wasn't sleeping with Stormy Daniels.
Yep.
No one even alleged he was, right? And he did this thing anyway to pay her off. Or in this case, there's no reason to create fake electors for yourself. You know, there's no reason for Kelly Ward. She's the chairman of the GOP. Yes, she wants a Republican president. If he's the beneficiary, how can he be an unindicted co-conspirator and not indicted?
So the answer to that is certainly if you are a prosecutor, you want to get to the top.
Yes.
I mean, there is no question. I've done organized crime cases where your goal is to get to the boss if the proof will get you there. When I worked on the Enron case, you want to build your case up to see if you can get to the CEO if he's or she is involved. That's what you do. Usually the reason is you just don't have enough proof.
Right.
It doesn't mean that the person's not involved. You obviously think if you could say they're an unindicted co-conspirator, that means that you think you have proof at least at the what's called a preponderance, which is more likely than not.
Right.
We've actually had two judges say, one has said it's a preponderance, another has said there's clear and convincing evidence.
Sure.
So it's not, there's proof, but remember, for a criminal case, proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Reasonable doubt.
So you know, it's clear. I mean, if they brought this case and they're not yet at that level.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're not going to get there, by the way. They're
not there now.
Exactly. But yeah. You know what? People can cooperate. I mean, there's no question that, as Vaughn said, there are people with direct evidence.
Yeah.
Because Donald Trump at some point was like, I'm getting on the phone.
Yeah.
So he's got exposure.
An indictment clarifies the mind. If you weren't thinking about cooperating before, indictment
exactly.
is a clarifying experience. Tim Hafey, one of the unindicted co-conspirators I am now getting is an unindicted co-conspirator who is redacted defendant. That's what we've got here. I'm updating it even as we speak. One of the redacted defendants is called the mayor. So I think we can make a sort of logical assumption that the mayor is probably Rudy Giuliani. I'm going to get your reaction to that apparent update that one of the redacted defendants is called the mayor.
Makes perfect sense that Giuliani would be one of the defendants in this case because he was arguably the quarterback of the legal strategy that had multiple parts, including the fake electors. He was on the phone with people in various states, encouraging them to submit these fake electors. He's putting pressure on Republican state officials and ultimately members of Congress. He is the sort of designated primary legal advocate for this scheme. President Trump himself, it's important to keep in mind, we developed a lot of evidence of his personal role in discussions of and encouragement of the submission of these fake elector certificates. We had, for instance, evidence of a call with Ron McDaniel to some Republican officials in Michigan, encouraging them to submit these certificates. Obviously, you have the Georgia matter where that infamous phone call with Secretary Raffensperger. In Arizona, I know he had a lot of calls with Rusty Bowers about calling a special session. It may be that there isn't a phone call or evidence of the president directly encouraging the submission of fake electors in Arizona. I just don't recall whether or not there's direct evidence of solicitation of those fake electors. There is broadly, but is there in Arizona? There certainly is with Rudy Giuliani and other lawyers, Joy. My guess is some of those other redacted names. It could be John Eastman.
Oh, Tim Hafey. It's as if you're reading my mind. I have a Washington Post story in front of me. You're very wise. Let me just read from this. And I want to note that NBC News has not confirmed this information. This is the reporting from the Washington Post. I want to make that caveat right now. This is not NBC News reporting. I am now going to read the great Bernie, my stage manager, handed me his phone. So I'm going to read from his phone. An Arizona grand jury on Wednesday indicted seven attorneys and aides affiliated with Donald Trump's 2020 presidential campaign, as well as 11 Republicans on felony charges related to their alleged effort to subvert Joe Biden's 2020 victory in the state, according to an announcement by the state attorney general. Those indicted include former Trump White House chief of staff Mark Meadows, attorneys Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, and Christina Bob, a name we have not heard in these indictments before, top campaign advisor Boris Epstein, and former campaign aide Mike Roman. All are accused of allegedly aiding an unsuccessful strategy to award the state's electoral votes to Trump instead of Biden after the 2020 election. Your reaction to that, Andrew Weissman?
My reaction is, I mean, first, you know, wow, that is quite the, you know, this is like rounding up the usual suspects.
Yeah.
I mean, these
and throwing
people,
in Christina Bob. Like
Christina Bob, Boris Epstein.
And Boris Epstein.
But what name is not there? I mean, obviously, we've talked about Donald Trump and that issue. Chesbrough is somebody who, what this tells me is he's cooperating. I mean, really cooperating.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense that he would not be indicted.
And he's already indicted in Georgia. And so if you think about it, from his point of view, you might as well cooperate at this point.
And the issue there was it was unclear whether he is really fully cooperating. Remember when he pled, it was sort of like a, you know, I'm sorry I got caught kind of plea.
But so was Jenna Ellis. I mean, Jenna Ellis is somebody who has complained publicly that Donald Trump is not paying her legal bills, not helping her out financially. If she's on this list, does that mean that she's only giving limited cooperation?
That distinction makes it sound like she was not willing to go, you know, be fully on board and cooperating.
If I'm Jack Smith right now and I see this, I'm doing what right now, other than pulling my hair out that the Supreme Court is holding up my case?
Yeah, I mean, for him, Look, he already has a very, very strong case, or else he wouldn't have brought it. He needs to just get a trial date. I mean, that's, you know, the Supreme Court is standing between him and accountability. But this is all very good news because this is additional pressure on these people to cooperate. And it cannot be taken away by Donald Trump, even if he becomes president.
Yeah.
So, but also, if Chesbrough is really the person, there's got to be a reason that he has not been indicted. It has to be that he's cooperating. And so that is another potential witness for you in the federal case, if it ever goes.
And Tim Hafey, if you are Fannie Willis right now, and you have a sprawling indictment of your own, and now you have this sprawling indictment in the state of Arizona, you're doing what today?
You're following it closely. You're in touch with counsel to the defendants who are in both cases. You're in touch, arguably, with the attorney general in Arizona because the overlap between these cases is significant. Joy, in any conspiracy, there are sort of leaders and followers. Conspiracy is like a business, like make an analogy to a corner store, right? Everybody from the owner of the store to the clerk who takes your money, they're all working together to achieve some outcome. Similarly here, there are leaders and there are followers, right? Somebody like Jenna Ellis did not orchestrate the strategy. She's executing it. She arguably has less culpability, but really important information about the people that are sort of defining for her why this is important, what benefit it might have. So what often happens in a conspiracy is that the followers turn on, have a strong incentive to provide evidence against the leaders, the ones who are the architects. And here, that's the former president, that's Rudy Giuliani, that's John Eastman. They're the ones that sort of conceived of the overall strategy. And then some of those others, is like Mike Roman's another example, they just executed the strategy that was devised by someone else.
Andrew Weissman, I have to thank you, my friend. We have kept you much longer than we originally planned to do, but you were so gracious to come in and jump in and be my anchor buddy for this, because breaking news is always tough to do on your own. But having a really great former prosecutor sitting right here is so great to have. Thank you very much, my friend. I appreciate you. We are keeping Tim and Vaughn. They aren't going anywhere because we have so much more on this. I'm going to give Bernie back his phone while we take this very quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater. And this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Back now with the breaking news, the indictments in the Arizona fake elector scheme. We're back with Vaughn Hilliard and Tim Hafey. And joining me now is Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney and MSNBC legal analyst. Joyce, I'll go to you first for your reaction.
Well, I think it's not surprising that we've seen this indictment. What's surprising in some regards is some of the expansion here, the inclusion of Boris Epstein, the apparent sense that Kenneth Chesbrough may be finally cooperating since he is not indicted, but is discussed in the indictment. This suggests that prosecutors in Arizona have amassed the evidence that they need to go even a step further on prosecuting one of the many fake slates of electors conspiracies that took place across the country It is horrible news for Donald Trump in the middle of his criminal trial in Manhattan.
Indeed.
He's an unindicted co-conspirator in this case.
And very quickly, to stay with you for a minute, Joyce, I mean, there was a lot of criticism of Fani Willis when she brought a case against 19 people, a RICO case. This has got one more than that. This is 20 people, 11 in the state, and then 9 additional people whose names were originally under seal. I mean, this is an even more sprawling case, as you said, with even more people that we hadn't heard before. Christina Bobb had not been in before, Boris Epstein. So kind of, to me, is pretty much a vindication, in my mind, at least, of what she did in Georgia.
Well, I think it suggests that Fani Willis was the immaculate career prosecutor that we know her to be. Tim will tell you this, too. When you're a prosecutor, there's no arbitrary limit on the number of people that you indict in a case. You indict the people who you have evidence against, core participants when you've got a conspiracy setting like this, and you don't arbitrarily say, well, I've only got room for 12 people or I've only got room for 13 people. Your job as a prosecutor is to hold people accountable for criminal conduct, and that appears to be what's happening in Arizona tonight.
And Tim Havey, give us some contours of this new set of names. You've got now Boris Epstein. We know he is an advisor to Donald Trump. We've got Christina Bobb, who is one of Donald Trump's lawyers. Interesting to me, I mean, John Eastman, who is one of the architects, along with Kenneth Chesbrough, of the idea of using fake electors. The fact that he's still in it, that he's in another one of these, is interesting to me. Mark Roman, talk about this newly expanded cast of characters and what they did from your role as an investigator.
Yeah, the two new names, Joy, are Christina Bobb and Boris Epstein. They have not been previously charged, but they were part of the team. They were part of the legal team. Christina Bobb is a lawyer, and a sometime television commentator, Boris Epstein, I believe is a lawyer, was involved in perpetuating the fake elector scheme, calling people in Arizona and encouraging them to submit these fake electors, not just Arizona, but part of the overall strategy. I would say Epstein is very, very close to the former president. He is one of those people that even to this day continues to be part of the legal apparatus that is trying to assist the former president. So he has maintained a very close relationship with former President Trump. Christina Bobb, I don't know, is still in the orbit. But for a period of time, they were two of the voices. Going back to what I said before about leaders and followers, mm-hmm. neither of them were the architects of the strategy. John Eastman and Ken Chesbrough, and then Rudy Giuliani as kind of the quarterback, they are sort of the leaders of the conspiracy in terms of directing the actions of others. So Bob Roman is not a lawyer, was just a Republican National Committee staffer that was essentially facilitating the submission of these certificates. They have strong incentive because they are less culpable to provide information about others further up the conspiratorial level of culpability.
Indeed. Vaughn, let's talk about some of these state actors here. One of them is a state senator, a sitting state senator. His name is Anthony Kern. He did do a press conference on Monday denouncing Attorney Mays and saying that she was trying to use lawfare to keep him from running for office this year in 2024. A little more about him. What do you know about him?
Right. Anthony Kern has become a well-known name inside of Arizona, largely because of not only his staunch defense of Donald Trump, but the lengths to which he has gone to defend him, including going to the Capitol on January 6th. We should note that he was not formally charged as part of his attendance there that day. But Anthony Kern was somebody who, if we go back to 2021, again, this was a sustained effort. Folks will remember the cyber ninjas, that it was the state legislature that ultimately subpoenaed the ballots, and they hired an outside firm along with volunteers. And one of those volunteers and one of the leading actors to have that forensic audit, so they called it, was Anthony Kern. He was on the front lines of that. He was a frequent one of the volunteers, state legislators. He was on the front lines there. If I may, Joy, also, just when we're talking about Christina Bobb, just a month ago, in fact, Christina Bobb was just formally brought on. She was with the Trump campaign here, this 2024 campaign. She was just formally brought on by the RNC as a counsel position for their election integrity efforts here. So for this upcoming election, so she is still very much a player, much like Boris Epstein, continues to work out of Palm Beach with Donald Trump, helping with his legal team, essentially working with all of his different counsel for all of his different cases, and works to kind of come up with a common, you know, with the former president strategy. And Joy, also, we were working through just this indictment here real fast. It was able to make it to the point here where we were talking about John Eastman. There was some revelation here that was named from May's indictment that I, if I could just read it here,
please,
in which she outlines that on talking about John Eastman, whose name is redacted, but we believe this is John Eastman, on January 4th, 2021, John Eastman pushed then Arizona Speaker of the House, Rusty Bowers, to convene a special session to decertify Arizona's presidential electors, telling him to, quote, just do it and let the court sort it out. Bowers declined to do so. Then on January 4th, Eastman met at the White House with unindicted co-conspirator number one, former President Trump, Mike Pence, and others to convince Pence to reject or at least delay the confirmation of the lawfully chosen electors 2 days later at the joint session of Congress. So to the point that you guys are just making, clearly, whether it be Kenneth Chisborough or John Eastman himself, there are individuals who are opening and working with the Attorney General Chris Mays leading up to this indictment here today.
Wow, that is interesting information. Thank you for that update, Joyce. Your reaction to that, and just on the fact that Eastman is now multiple times indicted in this scheme, his law license has been challenged. This has ruined his life, but this has been sort of his, you know, white whale since the year 2000 election. This idea that states could just overturn the will of the people and put whatever president they preferred in. This is a belief system he's had for a really long time. Give me your reaction to this new indictment and what we just heard from Vaughn about the details.
Yeah, I mean, this, I think, illustrates the principle of play stupid games, win stupid prizes. This was an effort by John Eastman, by all accounts, a formidable constitutional scholar, to subvert the process to achieve a result that he wanted, not the result that voters wanted, not the will of the people, but the leadership that John Eastman thought the country should have. And so he took his knowledge about the Constitution and the law and came up with a slippery plan that he, as Vaughn was just reading, thought he could advance far enough to take time and delay to let the court sort it out. And of course, we all know how that came to sort of the fullness of the plan on January 6th, when the hope was something, some desperate last-minute Hail Mary strategy could be used to prevent Congress from certifying the Electoral College vote for Joe Biden. So this really is, I think, in many ways, we're finally seeing, although it has taken years, investigators and prosecutors have untangled the scheme. And they're seeing how folks who at the time said, oh, we're only pursuing processes that are legal, we have doubts about the election and about fraud, they really didn't have those doubts. There was no evidence of fraud. Many, many courts at this point in time had rejected Trump's lawsuits trying to demonstrate fraud. And what this was just a desperate grasp at holding on to power. That, I think, is what this indictment illustrates. And this is the point in time where often you will see people turn on each other in an effort to save themselves.
Yeah.
As you've pointed out, John Eastman lost his livelihood, lost his license, lost his career, lost respect. There's only one way for someone like that to come back. It's the John Dean story. It's cooperating and moving forward. We don't know if that's true for him, but the appearance is that Kenneth Chisborough is cooperating.
I will repeat what I said to our friend Andrew Weissman earlier. An indictment certainly clarifies the mind. If there is any thought of cooperating for any of these 20 people in the state of Arizona, now is the time. First one in the door gets the best deal. Vaughn Hilliard, Timothy Hafey, Joyce Vance. Double thanks to Vaughn for getting and scrambling in front of the camera and going through that indictment so quickly and giving us that breaking news. Thank you very much, my friend. I appreciate all of you. And we will be right back.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater. And this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best.
The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Imagine for a moment that you are 16 weeks pregnant. You're excited. This is a blessing. Now imagine planning that baby's life. Their first smile, their first laugh, their first word. Except one morning you wake up and all of a sudden you feel a gush of fluid. Your water just broke and you've had a premature rupture of membranes. The doctors at the ER refuse to treat you because in normal times, the recommended standard of care would be to end the pregnancy. Now, in our new Alito Dark Ages, they send you home and wait for you to come to the brink of death. And maybe then they'll consider helping you. This isn't a hypothetical situation. It's a real woman in Florida, but she could be anywhere. This is medical care in a post-Dobbs America. This is what Donald Trump and Justices Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett did to women in this country on purpose. Because of their decision overturning Roe v. Wade, doctors and women are in impossible situations. Some, maybe many, will die. The Biden administration has tried to find a way to help protect them. In July of 2022, HHS Secretary Javier Becerra, on President Biden's orders, told states with draconian abortion bans that they had a responsibility under a federal law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA, to provide pregnant women with stabilizing health emergency care, even if it includes abortion, or face losing federal funds. That directive put federal law in direct conflict with the laws in 14 states that now ban abortion at all stages of pregnancy, with very limited exceptions. Earlier today, the Supreme Court heard arguments on who has the final say, these red states or the government. The four female justices, the only members on the bench who actually know what it's like to be a woman, asked Joshua Turner, chief of constitutional litigation and policy for Idaho's attorney general's office, why abortion isn't health care and why women should be left to die.
The federal mandate is to provide stabilizing care for emergency conditions, regardless of any other directive that the state has or the hospital has that would prevent that care from being provided. That's the work of the statute.
Idaho is saying, unless the doctor can say in good faith that this person's death is likely, as opposed to serious illness, they can't perform the abortion.
I guess the question here is, do you concede that with respect to certain medical conditions, an abortion is the standard of care?
No.
The conservative male justices, especially Samuel Alito, seemed irritated with the lady's line of questioning and seemed to care less about the danger Idaho's abortion ban poses to women's lives than what bringing this case does to the state's authority. It's not clear which way the court will go, although they did allow the Idaho abortion ban to go into effect without federal repercussions back in January. If the conservative majority upholds that vision, it will further deepen the devastation and deadly consequences that pregnant women are already experiencing. Just look to Idaho. They have lost 22% of practicing obstetricians since their abortion ban took effect, according to a report by the Idaho Physician Well-Being Action Collaborative. More than half of their high-risk obstetricians have left the state entirely. And why wouldn't they? And their hospitals are seeing a third or half as many OBGYNs applying for jobs. I mean, would you want to practice medicine in a state that could send you to prison for taking care of your patients? I think not. Joining me now is Dr. Kylie Cooper, a maternal fetal medicine physician. Dr. Cooper worked in Idaho, but moved out of state after the abortion ban was enacted. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Cooper. Tell us why you moved out of the state.
So I moved to the state to take a job as a maternal fetal medicine physician and to serve the people of Idaho in caring for complex pregnancies. And after the abortion ban went into effect, it affected my ability to practice medicine in the way that I was trained, evidence-based obstetrical care. And so initially, after the ban went to effect, I was hopeful that lawmakers would listen to physicians and healthcare providers in terms of the harms that this would cause. But unfortunately, that didn't seem to be the case. And so in thinking about my own future in Idaho, having cared for complicated pregnancies and people experiencing emergencies, the idea of having to withhold treatment or delay treatment when somebody's having a life-threatening or serious pregnancy complication, because it was now deemed illegal, was just more than I could bear. Yeah. And so ultimately, I made the very difficult decision to leave the state of Idaho.
And you're far from alone. A lot of doctors are leaving these states for the same reason. I want you to listen to the architect of the end of Roe v. Wade, Samuel Alito, in his indignation, talking about your state. Here he is.
So we have this phrase, emergency medical condition, in that provision. And then under E1, the term emergency medical condition is defined to include a condition that places the health of the woman's unborn child in serious jeopardy. So in that situation, the hospital must stabilize the threat to the unborn child. And it seems that the plain meaning is that the hospital must try to eliminate any immediate threat to the child. But performing an abortion is antithetical to that duty.
But in a circumstance...
You go so far as to say that the statute is clear in your favor. I don't know how you can say that in light of those provisions that I've just read to you.
Well, what are you... I know how I feel about listening to him pretend that he knows more than a doctor about treating a patient. How do you feel listening to him talk like that, as if he knows better how to treat a fetal emergency than you do?
Yeah, it's very disheartening. I think certainly as a maternal fetal medicine physician, it's my job and my goal to have the best possible outcomes for my patients and their babies. But the sad reality is that pregnancy complications occur every day. And in some circumstances, they occur early in the pregnancy, where no matter what we would do, we cannot save the fetus. And continuing the pregnancy in the setting of specific complications places the patient at risk, not just their life, but of losing their uterus, losing, you know, their ability to have more children in the future, having, you know, damage to their kidneys, their liver, having bleeding in the brain with a stroke or seizures. So there are situations where sadly, you know, the pregnancy has to end for them to survive it.
I want to note for our audience that Arizona, the Democrats there have now overturned their 1840s era abortion ban, a law that was passed in the 19th century. They have overturned it in the House. It still has to go to the Senate. It was a 32-28 vote. I can't believe 28 people voted to keep this old law. Given the fact that many of these laws, Dr. Cooper, were passed before women even had the right to vote, when slavery was still legal, do you believe that women are safe in states with these particularly total abortion bans? Are women safe medically?
I think that we as healthcare providers and obstetrical providers, like, we want to do everything in our power to protect our patients. And the idea that we may not be able to do that is just very demoralizing. But I worry that in states with these abortion bans that we just can't provide the level of care that we should be able to, and that we, that our patients deserve to receive. And so I do worry this is going to cause a lot of harm to people.
And by the, our women, I mean, so, I mean, I think you're saying yes. I mean, you're saying no, women are not safe, right? I mean, women are not safe in a state where somebody with your medical knowledge is not there anymore, where they can't get treated by somebody with your knowledge, and where abortion providers, not just abortion providers, but just OBGYNs are leaving. Are women safe in a state where they just can't get OBGYN care?
Yeah, so absolutely, this is creating these maternity care deserts.
Yeah.
In Idaho, we're already there, but yeah, are worsening.
Yeah.
And especially in more rural states, there's a safety net of subspecialists and yeah, OBs and different providers. And when you start losing pieces of that safety net, yeah, things start to fall apart. So absolutely, this is dangerous.
Dr. Kylie Cooper, thank you so much. And that is tonight's readout. You can follow me on TikTok at Joy Reid Official and on Instagram at Joy Ann Reid. Follow our show's accounts on Instagram and TikTok at The Readout.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.